I have been the program manager since last September 1970. Prior to that time, which would take us back to about December of 1969, I was the deputy program manager. Hal Raiklin being the program manager. Then for something on the order of 3 years prior to that, I was assistant program manager for the business side of the program, if you will. Program planning and control, financial operations, contracts, material, configuration management, data management, all of the disciplines that fall in the area that you would normally call the business management or business administration side. Won't bother to go through the two or three iterations of organization that would put one function in and add another, subtract one, those kinds of things. During that time, one that might be significant somewhere along the way, I was also responsible for something called Saturn applications or derivatives, meaning the beginning to look forward to what other uses might NASA make of hardware similar to the Saturn V and in specific Saturn II hardware. Okay, now that would take us back to 1966 roughly. I was with Space Division but in the central organization. I was director for Space Division of something called management planning and controls, which involved the establishment of current policy and procedure for the division as well as long-range planning. Prior to that, I headed up a function reported to the president's office and was involved really in evaluating the operations of all of the activities of Space Division. I joined Space Division in 1962 after a little over 10 years in the Air Force. In the Air Force, the latter 5 years was associated with the Air Force's ballistic missile program, which I mainly concentrated on the Titan program. And was in the Titan system program office. Jobs that started as chief of the airframe division and ended up as a assistant deputy program director. Prior to that time, Air Force assignments involved other kinds of engineering activities, as well as operational activities. Graduated from Georgia Tech with a degree in aeronautical engineering, and have a master's degree in business administration from Pepperdine University.
Good, that answers many of the questions I would have. put to you over the course of this interview. Well, I think where I'd like to start is back to the days of the Air Force. I want to examine some of the transfers of procedure, management controls, and what have you that came out of the Air Force ballistic missile programs, Shriver's office, what have you, came into North America and into NASA. And I guess we'd like to talk about for a while the various management techniques that you learned in the Air Force that were adopted by the Air Force and applied to the management of the S2 program.
Okay, that's interesting. That's, I guess, an aspect, John, that I've not tried to collate in my mind in any fashion and talk to someone about before. So these will be kind of random thoughts. And I guess I'll have to own up quickly to the fact that what I'll try to do is give you some examples, which will be by no means all-inclusive.
Rather have it that way.
One or two very specific things. One of Shriver's strengths, I think, was in his continually having contingency plans, continually thinking forward to this is a great plan, but what if this part of it doesn't come to pass? What do we do then? I know several of us that have gone into industry have taken that kind of thinking and applied it. We apply it here on the SADC program. During the time that I was assistant program manager for program planning and control activities, the program manager was Bob Greer. Good. And you know his background also in the Air Force. And he had instilled that kind of thinking on the Saturn program. Another specific example is a thing we call a red bandit system, which is a precise, direct steel, I guess one would have to admit. General Tom Garrity, when he took over the Ballistic Systems Division after Ben Shriver moved to AFSC. Tom Garrity had a system he called the Red Bandit System, which was a means for identifying critical problems, assigning a specific senior person to work the solution of that problem, and the system provided for a reporting, periodic, very frequent reporting on the status of the problem and forecasting resolution of it. We use that here at Space Division precisely as it was generated by the Air Force.
Still in use, is it?
Yep. In fact, interestingly, it's been used for technical problems for years. Maury Don, the Vice President Controller, has just started using it in connection with indirect budget problems.
Is that right?
Same form and everything. And he calls it, I think, critical problem report instead of Red Bandit. Mm-hmm. But the Red Bandit was a slang name. The proper title of the system is Critical Problem Reporting System or something like that. And it goes on a form that has red border across the page and that kind of thing so that it catches your attention. So it's being applied in the business side as well as the technical problem solution side of the house.
This must go back to Tom Garrity's days in New Guinea, didn't it?
I'm not sure.
That's where he got the idea, because that's what they used to call Japanese fighter pilots when they were coming in on attacking the B-25 airplanes.
The term bandit.
Yeah,
a bandit was, it wasn't a red bandit, a B-25 bandit was an identified enemy.
Oh. Yeah, but it was also kind of a single fighter. I mean, it wasn't that you just said, you know, not using a formation. It was, you know, there were some bombers.
First of all, we back up one step, and this applies also. You have something called bogies. That's just something that's unidentified. There's another aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
We still, that's part of the Red Bandit system. Mm-hmm. We have bogies. We can go into the control center here next door, and we can see the list of about 13 bogies, some of which may become elevated to Red Bandits when they are identified as really being critical.
Mm-hmm.
And the analogy there was you spot something, and it was just a bogey. Someplace. When you identified it as an enemy, he became a bandit. I'm sure, yes, that that terminology that we used in identifying unidentified airplanes was the source for this Red Bandit system, but don't remember the Red being with it.
Well, I may have been wrong, but I was in Australia in 1943. I had met Schriever over there, worked with him, but at that time, Garrity had just left, and we sure used to hear a lot about Garrity after he left. He was a well-known person, an accomplished a lot. And then later I worked with him at Wright Field. So.
Well, the bandit and bogey thing was common terminology all over. I'm not sure if it's genesis would go way back before World War II.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Greer mentioned the whole idea of the staff meeting and management visibility and some of the problems you had here with the S2 before he took over. In fact, nobody knew what other parts of the house were doing. Could you comment on that for a little bit? How you manage a large operation like this, how you get control over it, and how you get this kind of visibility and data reporting, and what you need to control the organization?
I guess knowing that you have talked to Bob Greer already causes me to think I wouldn't have too much to add.
Okay, no, I didn't mean to do that.
No,
I understand what, you know, what I've done there.
Oh, I'm still going to talk.
Okay.
But it will be pretty repetitious, I'm sure.
No, what a historian tries to do is, you know, I stay in various places. I'm here with you, I'm with Greer, and I get a greater degree of intelligibility. I mean, you'll put the problem one way, you'll put it another way. Well, I'm not going to have a running account that you say this, he says that, and so on, just like criminal.
Oh, no.
I'm going to try to put it all together. And by having a number of people tell me what's essentially sounds like the same thing, I'm going to get a much broader picture. Now, I've heard about the Red Bandit twice before. But I've been connected with aircraft. Now, that's a nice little thing. And, you know, gradually I'll build this up into a...
Maybe I should put one more piece of that in context.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Garrity's use of the Red Bandit system was initially for the activation of ballistic missile sites. The ballistic missile site activation task forces out in the field called in Red Bandits to him. The system was successful enough in that kind of an operation that it got expanded to cover other types of problems at the contractors' facilities and so forth. And well, just to keep it in context, that's how he was using it initially, was with the Site Activation Task Force to activate the Atlas, Titan, and Minuteman ballistic missile sites around the country. A fantastically large job. He was needing any kind of visibility on the key problems, and that was the system.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say, before we get on to the other subject of the management, that there are many, many examples that we could fall back on of things used by the Air Force that were carried by people like myself, or Bob Greer, or Sherm Ellis, or Jack Proctor, John Pop, lot of ex-Air Force people mm-hmm. that came with North American, McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, and so forth, and brought along, tried and tested little techniques of that sort. Mm-hmm. On a bigger scheme, and a little less specific, would be things like the importance of having something specified, the importance of specifications, the importance of having a business system for carrying out something, the importance of feedback. I guess the military is kind of a classic place where it's common to give orders, but you've sure got to have a feedback, or you have no idea whether those orders are doing anything effective or not. Mm-hmm. That learning was clearly brought over by people like myself. That's not to say it wasn't here already.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to pick out any of these more general areas that mm-hmm. might not have been here going full bore.
Well, obviously the contractor's been talking to Air Force people for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Building planes and even missiles for some time by this time frame period. So obviously they've been borrowing techniques all along, whether you people come in and actually implement them or they see things from their meetings with you that look good, they probably would have adopted some of this material even before you got here, whether you came here or not.
And I guess that causes me to realize, John, really, that the Air Force might have borrowed them from some contractor initially.
Yeah. Well, that's
it is a team when the smoke all clears.
Oh, yeah. Now, I found with some of these boards that Boeing did a lot of these boards, and then they kind of passed out over the organization. And I found out from somebody that the Air Force had this system. Well, things are invented in parallel. And when the time is right for these kind of things, we have this program, obviously a number of people are going to be thinking of adding to this. NASA has a similar idea.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, you know, borrow quite readily from each other, and that's what I'm going to try to say. I don't know, probably very kind of impressionistic. You know, these techniques were all being developed in the aerospace industry during this time. Some mm-hmm. of them came from the Air Force, but it's not all Air Force.
That's right.
Very difficult to trace back, you know, the origin of the first occurrence of these kinds of procedures, and of course they're modified every time somebody uses them. The whole idea of PERT with the Polaris system, of course, got into the industry right away
mm-hmm.
when all of them was changed in the various other kinds
right.
of approaches.
Let me mention two other quick examples, and then we'll talk about management. The Air Force. Well, let's talk first about Ben Schriever developed something he called Black Saturdays. I don't know whether those have been mentioned to you before or not, but a Black Saturday for Schriever. Once a month, he had all of his senior staff and his program directors in a meeting in which the program directors would report in detail on the status of their programs. Every time they identified a problem, he then turned to the staff member, and when I say staff, I'm really talking about functional head. If it was a mm-hmm. material problem expressed by the program director, then to the head of material went in action to get in and help solve that problem. Personnel, logistics, right on down the line. That technique, Bob Greer started applying to the Saturn program when he took it, and he was having Black Saturdays daily. And they were limited to about a 45-minute session, but the individuals responsible for each of the stages being produced would stand up and give the detailed status of the stage, mm-hmm. and Bob had sitting with him the head of engineering, the head of manufacturing, the head of test, the head of logistics, and so forth. And as that man would identify a problem that was holding him up or whatever, then how go the actions for these fellows. We went for about a year with the meetings being every day, and then shifted and sometime in 67 or 68 to three times a week. And we've now shifted them to twice a week. Okay, I had another example in mind, specific, what was it? I don't recall. I'll think of it in a minute and tack it in.
Okay.
Getting to the point of how to manage something like this. The reason I said if you had talked to Bob Greer that it would, I would feel that I probably had little to add is because I've never worked with any one person whose ideas of how to manage and mine were so completely in sync. So that I could just off the cuff agree with everything that Bob said, that type of thing.
And he said the best way to do is to have everybody else work for you, delegate all your decisions, and sit back and work yourself out of the job.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be
oversimplification.
Yeah. It's difficult, John, to keep from using the textbook cliches when you talk about management of a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, you've got to know what the task is. And in my view, knowing the task means putting on paper every thing that you can think about or that anyone suggests as part of the task, and pounding that around until you really have identified what's the thing you're setting out to do. Once you have that task identified, determine what kind of an organization you need to carry out that task. And don't be inhibited by what it was the last time you performed a task about like that. We are always very quick to say, oh, that job is just like the so-and-so job, and it rarely turns out that it is. Now, I, like Bob, am a strong believer in people. In the process of organizing, look to the blocks first, but I believe that an organization is its people, regardless of what the blocks say. So when you, after roughing out an idea of what the organization should look like in chart form, placing of people against those slots, I feel, should allow the box to change, the boxes to take on a different shape or title, a different mission within the individual parts of the org chart. Once you get the people in, people identified, and I guess this is kind of into the staffing of it, select people that you know you can give a job to, and they will do the job completely. Now, that sure sounds like a textbook. Let me try to say it a little different way. I think that one of the very keys to managing any big job is the people. And the person who's managing the overall job can't always have precisely the people he would like in each case. I guess the important thing is to know the people that you do have. Have them calibrated so that you know that yes, even though this man happens to be the director of configuration management, he's also just an all-around good troubleshooter. Or he happens to be very well versed in safety or whatever. Know the talents of the people and don't feel that you can only use them by what their title on the org chart says. Mm-hmm. Having the people calibrated, then turn over to them the jobs you feel that they're capable of doing. And I guess then, kind of as Bob Greer says, turn over every job to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Don't keep any for yourself, because the work of this job is not today's activities. It's next month. If you let yourself get involved in more than about 5 to 10% of today's activities, a month from now things will clobber up again. Okay, having given out the responsibility and accountability and the authority, of course, for the day-to-day tasks, you've got to have some visibility system, some statusing system. I should back up and say you've got to have some formality to the way you hand out the tasks. In my experience, the key to the formality is the budget. And I don't hand out budgets in an arbitrary fashion. The person responsible for that work and myself sit down and talk through the budget he's going to get. If he sincerely thinks he can't do the job for the budget I'm going to give him, then we'll find a common ground. But he signs up for the budget that he gets. We have a contract. And he knows then that I'm going to try to stuff everything into that contract that I possibly can. So my giving him work goes along until he feels stuffed. And that's when I know he's reached the limit of his resources, because I'm going to hold him to reporting against the budget that he's contracted for.
Now, you say contract. This is a... You've written, signed something you have to do with him?
Yeah.
He's going to do this? He has the budget of...
Yeah, we have a statement of he's going to do so much work within these dollars. And on the budget, on the Saturn program, the way I handle budgets is on an annual basis. We sit down before the beginning of each government fiscal year, each of the people who report to me, and we agree on the budget for that year. Now, my head of financial management has staffed this previous to this time, and he and I have worked out what we think the program should operate for the year. And then splintered up, I sit down with each of the functional heads, chief engineer, the director of manufacturing, the director of tests, and so forth. And having previously agreed to what the tasks are,
mm-hmm.
We then look at what the dollars are going to be, and he has staffed it out, and we kind of meet at the top and sign up.
Mm-hmm.
He signs a piece of paper recognizing an amount of dollars, and then I sign a thing handing him that amount of dollars.
And you're both as honest with each other as you can be. He's not trying to rat hole any money to protect himself against things that you might assign him later. And you're not trying to... run the organization for 10% less than your predecessor did the year before?
Not necessarily. I'm not.
Okay.
I do know, having been in their position, I do know that my ability to forecast what I need is very good for today and tomorrow and the rest of this week and the rest of the month, probably. But 3 months from now, mm-hmm. I'm not real sure what I need, so I'm just making my best three-cushion shot. And I know that that's what they're doing, and I know, therefore, that I'll be able to give them some additional work as the year grinds on without additional budget. And they know that they'll be able to accept it. And they know I'm expecting to give them more work, etc. So it is a very open thing. Now, it is normal, John, for me to hold some reserve. The government normally has a funding limitation on the year, so that I will, in order to prepare or protect against any problems or contingencies, I will hold what I call a management reserve.
Is this any set formula figure?
No, it, I guess it's a seat of the pants kind of thing.
Whatever you say from your negotiations with your friends.
That, really, I take the reserve, I establish it pretty early. And it is based on where the program is in its process. If we have a lot of hardware in manufacture, a lot of testing going on and so forth, I would tend to hold a larger amount in reserve. But, by the same token, there, during that part of the program, the government is funding more than early or late in the program, and so it's easier to hold out a larger amount. But I don't have any set percentage that I would hold back. Okay, work having been given out, I status in two or three ways. First of all, I have a financial status once a week. Each week I know the actuals expended and the forecast of what we're going to spend for the year. And I, then that weekly accounting is broken down again by these individuals to whom I have given budget, so I know exactly where they stand and in total where we stand. I have mentioned previously that twice a week review the schedule status of everything that's going on within the program. And that's not limited just to hardware. If we have a major study, of which at this particular point in the program we have probably half a dozen very major studies, we status those in detail. We status the activity.